This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening.
There are places I remember.
Memories, musical and maniacal, of the magical moment when the Beatles landed in the U.S. back in 1964. I was studying classical piano back then and was such a geeky skeptic of rock and roll as an 8-year-old, I'm embarrassed to recall arguing about why Beethoven's long hair was more appropriate than the Beatles with other kids in my school. I eventually stopped being such a dork and managed to love Beethoven and the Beatles. We remember the Beatles' arrival in the U.S. this hour, a look back at the Ed Sullivan Show, and a look forward at the Beatles' many-layered influence on popular music far and wide. Also, Facebook writes your biography to sort of show off all their clever algorithms and to make a point about online archiving. But first, a case of sexual abuse in a world closed to the public. Allegations that are distasteful and horrifying because they involve children. Allegations that are toxic and inflammatory because they involve institutions and individuals that represent ideals of perfection, virtue, heroism, artistic achievement, creativity. I could be talking about the Catholic Church and young boys. I could be talking about a high school football team and some young girls. I could be talking about legendary actor, director, and comedian Woody Allen and his young children. In all three cases, people took sides, defending the church and the priest's sexual abuse cases or defending the victims. Defending the high school football team in Steubenville, Ohio, as being slandered, or defending the young women charging rape at a party that clearly got out of hand. And there are legions of fans defending director Woody Allen when he says the allegations of sexual abuse from his 28-year-old adoptive daughter Dylan, when she was 7, are untrue and disgraceful. And there are legions of outraged, possibly former fans condemning Allen as a predator. In each case, a closed world of a church, a tight-knit team, or a family prevents the truth from being known. It's estimated in national statistics that 93% of juvenile sexual assault victims know their attacker. And in more than 1 in 3 of those cases, the attacker is a family member. What is our business here? There are barriers to telling and to investigating these kinds of sexual abuse cases that hinder our ability to have a coherent national conversation about them. Sasha Weiss, literary editor at TheNewYorker.com, recently blogged that the idea of "it's none of our business" constitutes a dangerous boundary between private life and public health. Also with me is Dr. Margaret Moon, assistant professor in pediatrics and clinical ethics at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much.
So, Dr. Moon, what do you think about the barrier of people believing that it's nobody's business what goes on inside a family regarding sexual activity, sexual abuse, the kinds of things that we've talked about in some of these controversial stories?
There's sort of two important aspects to it. As a society, we do work really hard to protect families because families are important to the well-being of children, and families, we have a sense that families deserve some privacy. But that ends up being secondary to our more important duty to protect children. So I think that the hard stop against the privacy that we afford families is the protection and the well-being of children. So it is our business when children are suffering.
And it might be your business as a professional, as a a pediatrician, and it might be law enforcement's business. But in general, the public doesn't consider it its business.
Well, again, I think that there are restrictions. If you see something happening in a public space, if you're in the grocery store and somebody's about to hit their child, that's actually a very public act. And I think that we may have a duty as citizens or as people in this society to offer some assistance to that situation, not necessarily judging, not necessarily condemning, but just understanding that people are suffering and it might be a good time to step in and see if we can help ease the situation to protect the child. Things that happen inside a household end up not coming into the public eye unless, somebody brings them into the public eye. So, those two things are different situations. Both of them matter. We don't have as much access to what happens inside the home, but when it becomes public, our duties probably change.
Sasha Weiss, Dr. Moon makes a good point. If Woody Allen had been seen, kicking one of his kids around in the Fairway Market, we'd be having a fundamentally different conversation about all this than we are having now. What do you make of the fact that there is this none of our business barrier here?
Well, it's very complex because this is a case that took place a long time ago. It was never prosecuted in court, although the legal inquiry has a lot of ambiguity to it. There's an added barrier of time having elapsed and the case never having been adequately resolved. But now we do, essentially, it has come into the light. I mean, we don't see him hitting his kid in the supermarket, but his kid has come out and said this happened in startling detail that's very arresting and hard to ignore.
You know, there's also a full spectrum here, because back in the 80s and 90s, there was a whole series of stories about suppressed sexual abuse memories that created these celebrated trials in Los Angeles and on the East Coast, resulted in some cases in convictions, but in other cases the memories were found to be false, and it absolutely destroyed certain families. So it's very, very difficult to see this clearly.
I agree, but that's why I think the case is important to talk about, because it raises exactly those questions. How do we understand testimony from a child who's in some kind of traumatic family situation? I mean, whether or not sexual abuse occurred, it was a very complicated household undergoing very complicated emotional stuff going on there. So how do we understand her testimony? How often does false testimony take place? These are questions that are being posed by this case now. And I think that it's not that often that a case like this is aired in such a huge way in the national news. Usually when we read about rape cases in the national news, they're public violent crimes that we can all get very upset about.
Do you think there's a "if you see something, say something" mechanism for allowing kids, empowering kids to raise their hand early on so it doesn't have to be this trauma when they're adults? I can tell you, and Dr. Moon, I know you're with me on this. I can tell you that with my own daughters in their health classes these days, there are explicit discussions of what should and should not happen and what can and cannot happen and what should and should not be reported. And my kids seem very empowered. Mm-hmm. Margaret Moon, is that the wave of the future in terms of education, in terms of the way we acculture kids to this kind of activity?
Well, it's been our approach to education around safety in kids for a long time. So this is not a new thing to tell children that there are boundaries. This kind of touching is okay. That kind of touching is not okay. But what we have never been all that great at is allowing children to actually speak out. So we have made good strides in helping children and families to understand that we ought to speak out. But I don't think as a society we are quite far enough yet in terms of really letting children do so. So I think the training is there, but getting the training to be effective and getting children to actually learn to have confidence in raising their voice. I mean, this is, we're asking questions, we're asking them to talk about their parents, and the relationships between children and parents are incredibly important. And children are quick to understand that they need the protection of their parents. So it's, we're putting a lot of burden on the most vulnerable person in the room there when we're asking a child to speak out against their parents.
A thought experiment before we go. Imagine a child who has had an experience that is very similar to what they might be reading about or seeing online in these very public cases that we've been talking about. Is there a place for them to go to report that currently in our society?
As a pediatrician, I offer that to children. But again, it's the I am one person, I am one voice. So we look hard for the safety net around children. We hope that children have other responsible adults in their lives that they feel safe with. We hope that they can talk to a pediatrician. It is incredibly variable the extent to which that safety net is present and successful.
Well, thank you, Dr. Moon, for joining us.
Yes, thank you very much.
And Sasha Weiss, thanks so much for sort of sparking this entire discussion in your blog. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
In the wake of U.S. terrorist attacks, we have become accustomed to the phrase, if you see something, say something. Let a trusted law enforcement officer know if you think a possible terrorist is in your midst. Make the population at large the chief investigative tool. That's the principle there. Well, it's also the principle behind a more aggressive approach to curbing online bullying. The Kenilworth School District in New Jersey is adopting a program called Stop It. It's actually an app that gives kids the option to say something when they are being targeted or see someone else being cruel online. The app works by allowing teens to take a screenshot of online bullying and then send the shot anonymously to trusted parents and school administrators. Joining us now are Dr. Scott Taylor, superintendent of the Kenilworth School District. Doctor, welcome.
Hello, John.
And Dr. Elizabeth Englander is director of the Massachusetts Aggression Reduction Center at Bridgewater State University, author of the book Bullying and Cyberbullying, What Every Educator Needs to Know. Dr. Englander, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Scott Taylor, tell me a little bit about how the Kenilworth School District is going to make this work. You have to deputize parents and school administrators to be receivers of this information. It's not just a free-for-all.
We sure do, John. And after a hard court press to garner interest from about 700 kids and their parents. We will be providing them instructions and built-in contact information when we actually distribute the application.
Dr. Englander, what do you think is the implication of something like this, and how effective is this kind of intervention, do you think?
Well, I think that it's good, and I think that the school district is on target in saying that this is one way of helping kids to report, to make it easy. But I think ultimately, and I'm sure that they know this, we really need a multi-pronged strategy to encourage reporting from kids. Just one strategy is really not going to fit every situation, because there are many different reasons why children don't report. And we really want, in the end, to make kids more resilient. It's not just about reporting, right? Because we want kids to be able to cope with meanness when it happens.
Well, Superintendent Taylor, don't you run the risk here? I mean, kids are smart, and they're devious, and they're mischievous, and they're, you know, lovely, wonderful people. But, you know, they love to work the system. All of a sudden, you may have created a system here where people can do all kinds of false positive reporting and sabotaging certain people's academic career by just sort of messing with stuff.
When we decided to pilot Stop It for the company, I sat down with the maker of the application and I drilled him. I gave him all kinds of questions, one of which was speaking to your point. And the response from my administration team in that conversation was, you know what, we're willing to take that chance. And the likelihood is, after we come down swiftly on those kids who are abusing the application, we hope the message will get out that, hey, we're serious about this, and you better only use it for the right reasons.
Dr. Englander, two questions. One, do you think resilience is the better approach here, that basically if people could be immune to cyberbullying, that would be maybe better than trying to eradicate it as a matter of controlling speech? And how do you discuss the thresholds? I mean, what's the trigger? What's the difference between something that's just kind of nasty and something that is really over the line?
Well, I think that ultimately resiliency really has to be the goal, because we're never going to create a world where everyone is sweet and wonderful all the times. In terms of drawing the line between just what's mean and what's cyberbullying, you're right, Neil. There's a chronic overuse of these terms, bullying and cyberbullying, and that is a real problem. And part of what also has to go along with it is education about when something is really serious and, you know, when something is more run-of-the-mill and it's better just to ignore it or shrug it off.
Dr. Elizabeth Englander is director of the Massachusetts Aggression Reduction Center at Bridgewater State University and author of Bullying and Cyberbullying, What Every Educator Needs to Know. And Dr. Scott Taylor is superintendent of the Kenilworth School District in New Jersey. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, John.
Whether you go on Facebook once a month or 12 times a day, you may have noticed that Facebook has been having a little fun celebrating its 10th anniversary, allowing users to create look-back one-minute videos, a personal highlights reel of most liked posts and pictures since the site began. Your life on Facebook, or Facebook's version of This Is Your Life. How does it look? Well, from Chesterfield, Missouri, yes, really cool looking back at personal milestones like my daughter packed in the car heading off to college.
Hi, my name's Cameron David. I'm calling from Livermore, California. And the thing that surprised me about those Facebook look back videos is how emotional it made me. Facebook, like it or not, has achieved a fairly institutional slot in our emotional and nostalgic centers. And it was kind of surprising.
There are some before and after pictures over the last decade, and tough times, too. From Toms River, New Jersey, I posted my Facebook look back video and was struck by two things. One, self-portraits of me were dramatic, and that since I joined Facebook, I've had a significant weight loss. Well, that's good. And two, my most liked posts were all about my husband's health. Shannon McNamara says, it seemed to pull quite heavy on statuses and photos that received a lot of likes or a lot of comments, so most of my video was full of comments and images received when my house burnt down before Christmas. Didn't post it because I didn't want to bum everyone out or myself again. Look back video is a clever, sometimes poignant way for the company to show off its fancy algorithms. It's also a not-so-subtle way to remind us all of the vast data archive stored by users on Facebook, the treasure that makes Facebook worth billions. But 10 years from now, will there be a million times more data on Facebook, or will it be Instagram or some other app doing the lookbacks? It's a great moment to speak with Sherry Turkle, professor of the Social Studies of Science and Technology at MIT and author of Alone Together, Why We Expect More of Technology and Less of Each Other. Sherry, welcome back.
Thrilled to be here.
So lookbacks and highlights reels are pretty interesting, but as a scientist, what do you make of this Facebook data set, and what does it say about us as individuals, and you know, what does it mean as a storage trove for sociological data?
So much. I mean, we're creating objects online that become our new kind of mirrors for how we think about ourselves. And, you know, we're really faced with a choice point. Are these new narratives online going to become how we see ourselves? Or are they going to be sort of jumping off points for us to feel free to create our own interesting narratives? Or are they going to start to constrain us by feeling that we've documented our life on Facebook and that is our real narrative? Because after all, what we put on Facebook is not really our life. It's the life we've chosen to put on Facebook. And I think people know that difference. But when you have your life represented to you on Facebook, it can start to feel like the same thing.
You know, I'm wondering if the trajectory is away from spontaneity. I think originally people went on Facebook and discovered that they could live in this parallel universe, and some people had some real difficulties there. And now you're finding, particularly with corporate interest in Facebook and marketing interest in Facebook, that it's a much more scripted narrative as time goes on. I'm wondering if 10 years from now, it's going to all look like the same sort of, you know, PR pitch for each one of us.
Well, right. I mean, I think when people first got onto Facebook, the idea was to really, you know, what's on your mind, share your day. And then gradually people started to put the happy story on Facebook because they wanted to be their best self on Facebook. And then as people realized that Facebook was a place where you wanted only your best self to be because your boss would be looking at it, where you got a job would depend on it, it became not just your happy self, but really the self you wanted to be, the self that you wanted to have scrutinized. So I liked your lead in that in years to come, people will find other places to put themselves, always trending to the place where they feel least scrutinized, I think.
So the trend is for Facebook to become mask book in a way, right?
Yes, I think it already is, but I think it always has been. I think in my research, I've found that people agonize over what to put on Facebook because that's the public part of you. And even when people, you know, say, well, that's where I show the life of my family, it's where they show the life of their family that they want to be shown. And I think that trend in all of us, that we live a life of performance because we're performing all the time on social media, that's what makes these new objects that show us who we want to be, and then we're asked to reflect back on this curated self that's already who we wanted to show, makes this such a curious game of mirrors.
A cemetery of dead wishes of what we wanted to be. Well, here, you know, speaking of death, one of our listeners has a fascinating sort of critique of the algorithms, and you guys all talk about algorithms up there at MIT all the time. I know that.
Yeah.
Here's someone from New York City who quibbles with the algorithm because in his or her look back, it said, a dead deer that was in my yard last year, I didn't realize was such a big part of my Facebook life. Somehow this dead deer picture is like huge.
Right. Well, this is another whole issue with the algorithms curating our narratives. You know, there are programs like 750 Words where you type something that's important to you and the algorithm tells you, you know, how you're feeling. And I've certainly interviewed people who are taken aback by what the algorithm is telling them what's important, that they're anxious or they're preoccupied with death compared to all the other people who were writing that day and according to the algorithm. And yet that doesn't feel right to them, But because the algorithm told them, it somehow takes on an enormous importance. Or algorithms that tell you that given your mood, or given your mood is shown by all the different information that you've had, that you've given it over over months, you're not feeling well, and then deciding to break up with your boyfriend on the basis of all this information. So this quantified self that we're starting to create through our profiles and this information, algorithms take this and tell us back their opinion of our lives. And that's starting to really weigh on people.
I think it makes a lot of people very nervous, and some it may delight. But the fact that there's no human making these decisions, but the user choosing to put these things on in and for reasons and at particular times that are almost random. Sherry Turkle, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Sherry Turkle is a professor of social studies of science and technology at MIT and author of Alone Together, Why We Expect More of Technology and Less of Each Other.
Dad, are any of these movies good?
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
Our lighthearted movie branding signaling that it's once again time to talk to Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Kristen Meinzer, a culture producer for The Takeaway. Welcome, guys.
Hi.
Hi, John.
But this is a somber week. We want to leave time in this segment to talk about the passing of Philip Seymour Hoffman. Your reactions, just as critics, as filmgoers, as humans?
I have to say I was totally shocked by his death, and but I think we'll always remember his legacy as one of the greatest actors, not just of our generation, but I think of all time. He was just fantastic.
Yeah, that's
in everything.
What people are saying. It's been amazing. Rafer.
Yeah, it was really sad to me to see somebody who was so universally loved and yet was somehow so unhappy and, you know, died alone in an apartment. That just struck me as really tragic. I was a huge fan. I never got to meet him, but this is one of those deaths of a celebrity that I don't know that somehow really hit me really hard.
Which fortunately you explored on the podcast, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But let's make a segue now, because I'm such a genius at that, to the releases this week.
Brilliant.
My kids, all right, are so what day this weekend are we going to the Lego Movie, Dad? That's the question all week.
We could build a submarine.
A bat submarine, patent pending.
With the rainbow.
And dream catchers in case we take a nap.
Like an underwater spaceship!
But you can't build all of them at once.
Ready, break!
All right, Legos as toys, fine. Legos as robots, interesting, new. Legos as cartoon characters, Legos as a movie, Rafer?
Well, I personally was looking forward to this for quite a while as well, and I thought it was fantastic. I think it is really inventive. The animation is wonderful. It's computer animation, but it looks like stop-motion animation, and they use little individual virtual Lego bricks for everything.
And
I buy it.
It looks
fantastic. I think the characters are fun. That's Morgan Freeman, by the way, you can hear in the voice cast. Everyone's having a great time. Liam Neeson. It's a lot of fun, I think. I love the movie.
Do we even want to talk to Kristen about this?
Don't listen to anything she's about to say.
All right.
Okay, Rafer, you said everyone was having a good time, except for the audience. This was nightmarish. It was like fireworks going off with a laser light show with a bunch of explosions, and then you set the whole building on fire. They didn't know when to stop. They just threw one glitzy thing on top of another.
Yeah,
it was so chaotic.
But what was wrong with it?
It was impossible to pay attention. It just eventually became dizzying white noise.
It's a movie about Legos.
I cannot recommend staying home enough. Play with
Can't
Legos.
You suspend your disbelief.
I love playing with Legos. Oh, nightmare.
All right. The next offering, I love that disagreement. The next offering is a directorial offering from George Clooney, The Monuments Men, going back to World War II, but it's all about the retrieval of stolen art.
Monuments Men, signed by Roosevelt.
Oh, I see that.
And to put a team together and try to protect what's left and find what's missing.
Aren't you a little old for that?
Yes.
You want to go into a war zone and tell our boys what they can and cannot blow up?
That's the idea.
Okay, how many men?
For now, six.
Jesus.
Good, bad, Kristen?
Unfortunately, it had the potential to be great. It's got that great cast, Clooney. It's got Matt Damon, Kate Blanchett. Great premise, but unfortunately, it just didn't know how to fix itself on its own.
I actually agree with Kristen. It's underwhelming for some reason. It's disappointing. Looks very nice. A lot of nice European backdrops and a great cast, but there's something a little bit not so exciting about the film. It leaves you a little flat.
Well, we can be excited about the way in which you take the Philip Seymour Hoffman story and really explore it. Who do you talk to on the podcast this weekend?
We talk to his friend and former high school English teacher, John Baines, who tells us about Philip Seymour Hoffman as a person, not just as an actor, just really touching.
Emotional?
Very. It's a very illuminating and I thought very poignant interview. He was a guy who was in touch with Hoffman for most of his life up until the month or so that before he died.
Wow. Definitely go to thetakeaway.org for that podcast. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks John.
So the opening day of the Sochi Olympics is not something that involves ice and snow, apparently, but instead a form of diplomatic chess, something the Russians are apparently very good at. It's Washington's move after this conversation between the State Department's diplomat for Europe, Victoria Nuland, and our ambassador in Ukraine was leaked, the two of them talking about efforts to resolve Ukraine's ongoing political crisis.
So that would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the UN help glue it and, you know, the EU.
That's the F-bomb there. U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine Jeff Pyatt seems to agree and wants Russia not to get wind of any of this.
We've got to do something to make it stick together because you can be pretty sure that if it does start to gain altitude, the Russians will be working behind the scenes to try to torpedo it.
The U.S. has condemned this alleged leak by Russia of diplomatic conversations, but it is a nice forking move on Vladimir Putin's chessboard, both asserting Russian power and warning about U.S. meddling in the affairs of Ukraine. And it's not the only move recently. Joining us is George Friedman, founder and chairman of Stratfor, a global intelligence company and author of The Next Decade. Looking at the board, George, how strong is Russia's position really, do you think?
The Europeans are fragmented and weak. The United States is not really engaged in spite of the F word. The Russians have fundamental national interests in the Ukraine. The Ukraine in the hands of NATO would represent a real threat to Russian national security. They are not going to let go. They don't mind what kind of government it has, but it cannot be a pro-European, pro-NATO government.
That's the short-term play, but long-term, is Russia's approach here and these Sochi Olympics notwithstanding, are we seeing a trend line up or down?
The 1990s were a catastrophe for Russia. It was inevitable that Russia would recover to some degree, and it has. And Russia is stronger, not so much because it is inherently strong, but because the Europeans are so weak and the Americans are so distant. There's really very little there to counterbalance them. So in the region at this time and for the foreseeable future, the Russians can make basically shape the region, and that's what they want to do.
And would you say that in terms of their relationship with the United States, is this a dust-up, or is Russia making a fundamental play that they can actually deliver on? It seems to me that with oil prices high, Russia is fine, but things start to slip, and Russia is ultimately very vulnerable.
Well, yes. I mean, that's ultimately their problem. They don't know what oil prices are going to do. But they do know that at this point in time, the United States can only do a dust-up. There's nothing fundamental the United States can do. The Europeans are weak. So this is their window of opportunity. It's probably going to close in a few years. So whatever arrangements they want to make in the former Soviet Union and among the former satellites, this is the time to do it. So they are moving fairly aggressively. And the moves that the Europeans have made and the Americans have made are really not nearly as heavy as it appears from the distance. They haven't been able to generate the kind of opposition they wanted. And they have the other problem, which is that Yanukovych, the president of Ukraine, was legitimately elected. Nobody questioned that election. And in a way, the Europeans and the Americans are now trying to use the demonstrations and his response to them to overthrow a legitimately elected government. And that gives the Russians a lot of leverage. What the Americans are trying to do here is reverse an outcome they didn't like, is the Russians protecting the status quo.
long term, and before we go, the Soviet Union, of course, collapsed. But is it possible that over the next decades, Russia's conquest of Siberia, the Caucasus, and some of the other places that it took over in the 17th and 18th century are also going to secede?
I think Russia is in a very weak position over the next generation. It's bet everything, as you said, on oil. Oil prices may not stay high, but you can't have an economy that's entirely dependent on European appetite for your energy, high energy prices, and they're not having alternatives. In the long run, I don't think the Russians have the ability to sustain the kind of empire they had.
George Friedman, founder and chairman of Stratfor, a global intelligence company and author of The Next Decade. And now, let's recall some comedians who had a moment in the spotlight 50 years ago like no other in the history of entertainment.
Who plans to inject us with enough alcohol so as to reduce us to nothing but a couple of raving, miserable drunks? Hey, holy hangover!
Frank Gorshin, established comedian and impressionist. He was on the same bill as these guys, Mitzi McCall and Charles Brill. It was the Ed Sullivan Show, the TV show in America that could make your career.
You're exquisite. You're beautiful. Why, a girl as beautiful as you would want to wear these glasses. Why, I think you're the ugliest girl I've ever seen in my life, sweetheart. Get out.
One night in 1964, these comedians were watched by 73 million people, perhaps the largest audience for any comics in history, and perhaps the absolute worst audience for people trying to get laughs. It was all screams and tears on this night as a near 24-hour riot in New York City came to a head with a performance that changed history, and that is no joke.
I felt sorry for the comics. Great story about McCall and Brill. They got a call. There were two young comics that, you know, the Ed Sullivan Show was like, you know, do the Ed Sullivan Show in your book for
this
the next
is it.
10
I
years.
Mean,
yeah, yeah, exactly right. Yeah, and that's what the man just said to him. He said, you're on with this group. And then they go, what group? Well, you know. So when they got to the theater, the screaming kids, they said to me, boy, I didn't know Frank Gorshin had that much of an audience. I said, no, you don't get it.
A lot of people didn't get these four guys from Liverpool, England, who arrived on U.S. soil for the first time. The Beatles, the advance team for what became the British invasion. Vince Calandra got it. He's the program coordinator for the old Ed Sullivan Show back in the 1960s. He recalls the meetings they had about booking the Beatles. Old showbiz Sullivan, Calandra says, was always looking for what excited the young people.
You know how agents are. The reasoning was like, well, Ed, we could always say that, you know, they were the first long-haired group to appear before the Queen of England, which was like, okay, you know.
Can you imagine what those meetings would have been like? I mean, Ed going, oh, we got to something for the youngsters. You know, he always talked about the youngsters, right? It was like, that was his big thing, the youngsters.
Yeah, that was his big thing.
Calandra said it was apparent that the Beatles could have carried off a British invasion all by themselves. He watched that night as the haircuts, the music, and faces of John, Paul, George, and Ringo changed history.
Now, yesterday and today, our theater's been jammed with newspapermen and hundreds of photographers from all over the nation, and these veterans agree with me that the city never has witnessed the excitement stirred by these youngsters from Liverpool who call themselves the Beatles. Now, tonight, you're going to twice be entertained by them, right now and again in the second half of our show. Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you.
It was incredible. I mean, 73 million people watched that show. It was incredible.
It was an expert bit of showmanship. They had a hit record in the U.S., I Want to Hold Your Hand, but they preceded it with Paul McCartney singing a Broadway show tune, the love song Till There Was You, to a swooning audience of young American girls.
There were bells on a hill, but I never heard them ringing.
When Paul did the song from Music Man, that was a good song for them because it kind of established them, other than the craziness of the first song. So we got the close-ups, and they got a close-up of Paul, and the kids are screaming, and then they go to George, and they put George's name underneath, and they're screaming, and they go to Ringo, and they're screaming, and then they go to John, and they got John. Sorry, girls, he's married.
John Lennon married not to Yoko back then. His first marriage would last only 5 years, but if there were girls in the audience disappointed by John's unavailability, Paul was the cute one anyway. There were plenty of people who said that this Beatlemania business was a flash in the pan, a fad, nothing more.
The most negative was our band leader, Ray Block, who said, I give them a year and they're going to, you know, they'll have one record and they'll be on their way. What about 1,600,000,000 records later, right?
Yeah. A phenomenon in music and entertainment worth more than billions that began with this U.S. TV gig for 10 grand from Ed Sullivan, three appearances. There was even an argument from U.S. Immigration as though the border police were trying to hold back this invasion, Philander says.
We had to prove to Immigration that they were unique and different. And most of the times it was like, you know, they had the hit record like Tom Jones or Petula Clark or somebody. We could never justify them coming in to the States because we would have heard it not only from Immigration, though, you know, we got all these American groups. You know, we would have heard it from the managers, we heard the record companies, agents, because when you did the Sullivan Show, that was it. It was like, you know, the Yankees, you're like winning the World Series and everything.
Who even remembers who won the World Series in 1964, right? It was the Cardinals, by the way. But when the Beatles lifted off from America in 64, it was a new game. Ed Sullivan's youngsters were about to grow up.
You know, all of us on the show are so darn sorry, and sincerely sorry, that this is the third and thus our last current show with the Beatles, because these youngsters from Liverpool, England, and their conduct over here, not only as fine professional singers, but as a group of fine youngsters, will leave an imprint with everyone over here who's met them.
And what about the comedians that miserable night, stuck in the fine print of history? Frank Gorshin had a fine career. McCall and Brill continued working, mostly daytime game shows. Vince Calandra recalls that McCall and Brill had a special funny moment with the Beatles backstage. But in the end, they would kind of blow the punchline.
And there's this guy standing there with funny hair and granny glasses, and he said,
"Give us a cork, love.
Give us a cork, love." And I looked at Mitzi and I said, "This guy wants a glove or something. I'm not sure what he wants." And he started to laugh and he said, "No, give us a cool glove."
And he pointed to the machine.
That's McCall and Brill speaking on the program This American Life.
So they started doing a routine and they were hoping to get rid of him. And then he says to them, "Do you mind if I sketch you?" And they go, "No, no, no, I ain't going to get rid of him." So he sketched them.
John Lennon sketches the two comics that were on the show.
Yeah, exactly. He sketches them. Leaves the pictures on the dressing room table. They throw it out.
A sketch by John Lennon, lost forever. You know, Lennon's handwritten lyrics of a Beatles song sold for $1.2 million back in 2010. So enough of the fine print. Fueled with Coca-Cola and with their entire future ahead of them, John Lennon and the Beatles ended the opening battle of the British invasion on the Ed Sullivan Show with their number one hit.
Oh, yeah, I'll tell you something. I think you'll understand when I say that something. I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. Oh,
the Beatles, of course, are much more than a band. They brought with them ideas about sex, religion, drugs, as well as rock and roll. They were experimenters and innovators who have influenced all music after them in virtually every genre. John Schaefer, host of WNYC's Soundcheck, says way beyond screaming fans, what the Beatles set in motion in the 1960s immediately ignited the musical world.
The thing that has struck me is how much the classical music folks took to the Beatles very quickly and continue to do so all these years later. Stokowski was a fan. Leonard Bernstein was a fan. They heard something in the Beatles early on that maybe a lot of other people weren't hearing.
Who has been influenced by the Beatles? Who's doing the Beatles thing today?
In a sense, everybody. I mean, but if you want to be specific, if you're looking for the big kind of iconic rock band right now, I would point to Radiohead, whose sonic proclivities are very similar to the late Beatles. I was thinking I would disappear. I would slip into a groove and cut me out. Cut me out.
You know, and this is late Radiohead, 2011, right. Lotus Flower from King of Limbs. They don't necessarily sound like the Beatles, but they have as distinctive a sound.
Exactly. And if you listen to this song, if you try and examine it, it's like, what are those instruments? What are they playing?
Yeah, yeah.
Many Beatles fans in the later years would have had the same reaction to some of the Beatles' later songs.
No, and the arrangements and orchestrations of the Beatles were indecipherable sometimes.
Yeah.
It was like the whole band was an instrument.
Right.
The big distinctive quality of the Beatles that I think heralded their arrival on the Ed Sullivan Show and afterwards was the vocals.
Those harmony-driven pop bands are sprouting up again all over the place, especially in places like Brooklyn and Silver Lake. You know, hipster culture has really glommed onto the Beatles harmony thing in a big way in recent years. There's a band I really love called Quilt. And their brand new album called Held in Splendor has a song called Arctic Shark, which to me has echoes of that kind of harmony. But here, too, you have a band with a very keen awareness of some of the avant-garde music that was being made in the 1960s.
Morning, how frozen, think and thaw and turn to brine. Salty workings in a restless process of mind.
That sounds very Beatles-like. I mean, that sounds like a cover.
Yeah. Now, the sitar-y guitars and the lush harmonies in the back of the primary vocal. Yeah. They name-check Beatles, but they also will name-check avant-garde artists like Terry Riley and Lamont Young, the founders of minimalism. Remember, the Beatles had Karlheinz Stockhausen on the cover of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Yeah, it sort of everyone in the universe was on the cover of the Sgt. Pepper album, that's for sure.
Right.
What do you think was the nature of the Beatles' experimentation? Was it the same as the Buddy Holly impulse to experiment, or was it something fundamentally different, much more diverse?
It was more diverse, and it was in large measure driven at times, not by the Beatles themselves, but by the fact that they were thrown into a studio with people like George Martin, who was a classical musician, a keyboard player, and had a keen ear of orchestration. And once the Beatles had access to that palette of sounds, the sheer invention, not just in the songwriting, but the way they got those sounds on those records using the technology they had is absolutely unparalleled.
A Martin-esque example of that kind of orchestration and experiment?
A.C. Newman, better known as Carl Newman from the band The New Pornographers. But I want to play for you a song, a deep track from one of Carl's solo records called The Slow Wonder. This, to me, is the modern version of the George Martin orchestration.
What is that, like six stand-up basses there in the back of the studio?
Cellos and horns, and there's a harp on this record, and trumpets, and it's all there. You know, this very orchestral palette, again, put to use in what is clearly a pop sensibility.
You know, for all the talk about how John Lennon and Paul McCartney didn't get along, their collaboration, of course, is one of the most famous in pop music, in music history. And bands to this day, I think, have a sense of collaborative spirit of multi-authorship that really, I think, begins with the Beatles.
Yeah, and it's funny because today the idea of the auteur, the singer-songwriter in his or her bedroom doing it all by themselves, is very much what people think of when they think of, say, indie rock. But we are beginning to see examples of two or more musicians who are really interested in that collaborative process. And possibly the biggest example on the scene right now is the duo known as Broken Bells.
I've been all around the world, but I got nowhere to go. I gave into this lonely life, and you can't change me now, so leave it alone.
This is James Mercer, who's the front man of the very well-known indie rock band The Shins, and Brian Burton, who is Danger Mouse, the guy who produced the Gnarls Barkley song, and of course, The Grey Album, his illegal mashup of the Beatles' White Album and Jay-Z's Black Album. The two of them co-write the songs as Broken Bells. Sometimes, they claim, when they are in the same room and writing, it'll be all four hands on a single keyboard. Mostly, though, these days, it's done by file sharing. But the outcome is the same. It's genuine co-authorship.
Think about how file sharing might have increased the longevity of the Lennon-McCartney relationship. Your last example here is a band I'm not familiar with, but tell me what this one's about here.
The Milk Carton Kids. Nobody's going to mistake this band for the Beatles or perhaps even for some species of pop. They sound like what they are, a folk duo. However, they share a couple of things with the Beatles. There's the dual composer thing. But the main thing that they have is this harmony-driven songwriting. Doesn't sound like the Beatles. It sounds like the Everly Brothers, who, of course, were the formative influence on the young Beatles.
Oh, snake eyes, you had better disguise all that appears of thee. Pray for love from the heavens above, laid in the ashes below.
There are places I remember.
Exactly.
You know, isn't it bring that back? Yeah.
There are a couple of old Beatles tunes that are not so far removed from the sound of the Milk Carton Kids in that song called Snake Eyes.
And, of course, we've just scratched the surface in our few moments together.
There's so much more.
Happy Beatles USA British Invasion 50-year anniversary, huh?
Happy anniversary.
John Schaefer. Host of Soundcheck on our partner station, WNYC. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
She's got a ticket to ride.
It's not exactly the Ed Sullivan Show, but if you like live music, big ideas, and hard science, we've lined up a fun and informative evening at WNYC's Green Space in Manhattan on Tuesday evening. Some acclaimed scientists will tell some unlikely stories of how they made it in science. We'll also have a band, a bar, and audience participation. Don't worry, we won't get too Blue Man Group on you. There's much more info at thetakeaway.org, including how you can get...
She's got a ticket to ride.
Thank you, Fab, for a ticket. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
She's got a ticket to ride, but she don't care. I don't know why she's riding so high. Sure thing twice, sure to ride by me. Before she gets to saying goodbye.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.